Hey everyone, thank you for checking out another podcast. Today I've got Ethan Rock with me. He's senior editor at Coffee or Die magazine. It's an online magazine. He just wrote a piece about the CHAZ or the CHOP in Seattle, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. He's here with me to talk about that today. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He's a former Marine and a combat correspondent. He's a Tillman Scholar. We're going to talk about that a little bit. And once we talk about the Autonomous Zone, we're going to talk a little bit about the lack of trust people currently have in U.S. institutions, both on the right and on the left, and how that expressed itself inside CHAZ while he was there doing his reporting. And we're also going to talk about how to move forward, how to reestablish trust in those institutions, and perhaps improve policing in the process. So I'm really excited about the conversation. I hope you enjoy it. If you find these conversations useful, please subscribe on whatever platform you're on and visit the website thomasowenbaker.com for more content. Thank you very much. Enjoy. Hey, thanks for joining me today. I really appreciate you taking the time. So I gave a brief intro, but we're gonna be talking about CHAZ, the CHOP, variety of different names it's been given. But before we do that, I just wanted to maybe get a sense of your lens, so your perspective on life and where you're coming from. Can you maybe just tell us, like, where did you grow up?
Yeah, so I was actually born in Canoga Park, the San Fernando Valley, California, just north of Los Angeles. But then I really grew up in the Sierra Nevada foothills of Northern California, real, you know, rural small town. It's called Ione, California. I used to joke, you know, we used to have two correctional facilities, a prison and a youth authority in my hometown. They ended up closing down the youth authority a while back. I used to joke, you know, back when I was growing up, I think our population was like 3,500 people, and they counted the prisoners from both institutions. So yeah, real small town in gold country of California. But yeah, that's pretty much my background. Native Californian, born and raised. Love California for many reasons, but had to move away a few years back. Cost of living was just getting a little too high.
Now you're up in Oregon, near Portland, right?
Yeah, I live in Beaverton, which is just a suburb just west of Portland.
What did your parents do growing up?
Say again?
What did your parents do growing up? What did they do for a living?
Yeah, so my dad was a bricklayer, a general contractor specializing in masonry. And he built, houses and all kinds of other buildings and, all things brickwork. And my mom was mostly a homemaker, but she, you know, occasionally would, go back to work to, you know, supplement the income. And so she worked for the state of California and did a lot of other stuff too, but she was mostly a homemaker.
And you were in the Army, obviously. We know each other through a veterans organization that we're affiliated. We'll talk about that in a minute. But what was your path into the Army? What sort of drew you there? Was there a relative or some experience that led you? Because I know you were in the Army and then the Marines. What drew you to that?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, I do come from a family with a long line of service tradition. You know, my grandfather on my mother's side was a Navy test pilot, grandmother on my mom's side was an enlisted woman in the Navy during World War II. Neither of my grandparents actually served in World War II, but served during that time. And I'm shaking my image here. Sorry. I have lots of extended family that have served, you know, great uncles, uncles. My dad was drafted, did his 2 years during the Vietnam era. Actually never served in Vietnam. As the story goes, as I've heard it, you know, he was like a motor transport guy. And, their unit got the call up to go. And then kind of at the last minute orders got pulled. So he was just stateside, did his time when he was drafted for a couple years. And, but really the real catalyst for me to join the military was, was my wife, my wife's influence. So, you know, I was actually a high school dropout. You know, I kind of flunked out of high school my senior year. You know, had bad my grades were so bad junior year. They were like, hey, you got to go to adult school, continuation school, get out of here. And I did that for a little while. And my dad was like, hey, why don't you just go get your GED and be done with it. And and so I did. And then about a year later, I met my wife the summer in between her junior and senior year. And so we were dating, and she decided, you know, she enlisted in the Marine Corps immediately after graduating high school. Well, before she graduated high school, but she left for boot camp shortly after. And I was that guy in high school who always kind of flirted with the idea. You know, the Army recruiter would come around to my high school, you know, and I'd kind of bro it up with him and be like, oh man, you know, like, I love G.I. Joe and, you know, like guns and war and shit, you know, like a lot of American, young American, kids do. And, but then I'd be like, you know, all right, I'm out, man. I'm going to go, get into mischief with my buddies. And, and then when my wife enlisted, you know, my girlfriend at the time, but when she enlisted and, you know, went to the Marine Corps boot camp and kicked ass. And I was just kind of like, you know, this is inspiring. You know, she's doing stuff with her life. And, I was like, maybe I should do that too. I want to say also that, you know, the backdrop there was I was also going to community college at the time. And, you know, and I love education and I was enjoying it, but I do remember I was very interested in the military. And I remember listening to a lot of people with really strong opinions. You know, obviously, you know, college and academia is full of a lot of idealistic young people, you know, and who have strong opinions. And, you know, I remember being kind of turned off by the certainty of a lot of those people, you know, and their how strong some of their opinions were. And, you know, so it was for me, it was like, you know, I've thought about this and flirted with this idea for so long. Maybe I should actually, you know, go live this experience and see what it's about. So I can really, you know, have a real opinion about it kind of, and not that you can't have an opinion about the military and foreign policy without serving, but you know, for me, that was important. And, like I said, my wife inspired the heck out of me. And so I was just like, let's do this, you know? I wanted to join, I wanted to follow Sabrina, my wife, into the Marine Corps. But I had a GED. Okay. A lot of people don't know. A lot of people don't know that the Marine Corps has some of the highest enlistment standards, right? Because we are the smallest of all the services, you know, we can kind of maintain those really high standards. So the GED was a disqualifying factor at the time. And so I was like, well, heck, I still want to join. Decided to go call up that Army recruiter who I knew from my high school. And he said, yeah, absolutely, man, you know, we'll take you. And so in when I decided to join the Army instead of the Marine Corps, because I was going to do the reserves like my wife had, you know, I was like, yeah, I want to go big. So I had watched, like I said, watched a lot of G.I. Joe and was familiar with like the airborne divisions and the maroon berets, you know, that like, was it like Lady J wears that thing or something, you know? And I was like, I want airborne infantry. And so, you know, enlisted with the 101st Airborne Division, Air Assault, did 3 years on active duty there. Sabrina followed me to the Army. Recruiter kind of hooked it up, and we served for 3 years together in the 101st. Did one deployment to Kosovo while I was there in 2000. And then I got out January 2001. Like a month after I got out, I was still on terminal leave. I was in the Marine recruiter's office.
Oh, really?
I was like, I can't do this civilian thing, you know. Like,
what was it about the civilian thing that turned you back?
It was, you know, it was. I mean, I as a young guy, like, I enjoyed that the martial culture of the grunts, you know, and like, and the discipline and the camaraderie and everything. Of course, you know, it's kind of like the similar thing that a lot of people go through when they leave the service. You know, it's like you're just kind of like, you know, like, and the other part of it was there's not a lot of opportunities for, you know, for an infantryman, right? It's like pretty much like law enforcement, security, maybe, you know, but there just wasn't much there. And so that was when I, you know, I knew that having an honorable discharge from the Army kind of upped my status for the Marine recruiting bureaucracy, basically, and that I could serve. It actually took me, I feel like I'm going really long here, so I'm trying to wrap this up. It actually took me about 8 months to get in, because when I went through MEPS and everything, I had a little bit of minor hearing loss in my right ear from, you know, not wearing my earplugs one too many times on a live fire range. And so I had a little bit of tinnitus. And like I said, the Marine Corps was just looking for reasons to disqualify people. They were making their mission like it was cool, didn't need to take a lot of bodies. And so they just, you know, like, hey, sorry, bud, you know, DQ'd me. I had to like write my congressman. Wow. And I had to like write my congressman this like, you know, dramatic letter about how it is a true story. I had my battalion commander with the first of the 187th infantry. He was my battalion commander the majority of the 3 years that I was there. He had a prosthetic leg. So this guy was serving with a prosthetic leg before it was cool. He lost his leg in a training accident and, you know, rehabbed and got back in it right away. And it's like, you know, you probably never would have known, you know, like, cause he was leading us on ruck marches out in the field, all kinds of stuff. So I wrote this letter. I was like, if this guy can lead an infantry battalion, one of the best infantry battalions in the Army, like the Marine Corps can take me with a little bit of minor hearing loss. And that was pretty compelling to my congressman. And he wrote a letter to the Marine Corps and said, give this guy a shot. And so I shipped out to boot camp 2 weeks after September 11th.
That's the first time I've ever heard someone writing to their congressman to get into the Marine Corps. I thought it was getting a congressman to help them get out of the Marine Corps. But that's a great story. It's fascinating. So when you went back in, you switched from being a Marine to being like a correspondent, like working as a journalist for the Marine Corps. How did that work?
Yeah, one of my favorite movies of all time is Full Metal Jacket. And as a young man, I had a VHS copy of that. You know, that I used to watch just constantly. You know. Always been a real big movie buff, you know, and that was like one of my favorite pastimes when I was younger, and still is, of course. But yeah, VHS Full Metal Jacket. I wanted to be Private Joker, from that movie, and that's the job that I sought out when I decided to join, because I was determined. I was like, this time around, if I get out, you know, I want to have a skill set that I can follow. And I had aspired to being a writer before I joined the military. Right. So that was always the plan. And I figured that if I could follow that path in the military, all the better. And one of the best decisions I ever made. Absolutely loved being a Marine public affairs guy / combat correspondent. And you know, best job in the military, in my opinion. And you know, it opened up, it gave me all kinds of opportunities and set me down this path to where I am today. So
just for people that are not familiar with it, and I'm familiar with the Joker. I love that movie growing up too. I don't really know much like about what a combat correspondent does. Like what is the day-to-day sort of tasks that you were carrying out? Were you like a, Is it journalism, or is it something different when it's in the military?
It's like journalism. You know, I, to put it hyperbolically, I like to joke, you know, that I was a propagandist for the Marine Corps, right? And that's actually kind of a reference to a historical quote. Harry Truman once wrote a letter. I can't remember exactly who it was to, like a Secretary of the Navy or something, or like, you know, one of his cabinet secretaries or something. And in the letter, he said the Marine Corps has a propaganda machine that it was something to the effect of Marine Corps has a propaganda machine that would make Stalin proud. And I think I would say that's fairly accurate. We do a really good job of telling our own story and promoting our brand in the Marine Corps. You know, I think today the military is still, if I'm not mistaken, unless it's changed in the last few years, is still one of the most trusted institutions, you know, governmental institutions in the United States. And I think the Marine Corps, especially, has has a lot of credibility and allure in the mind of the American people. And that's kind of our job, is to promote that brand and that image. And fortunately, it's usually a pretty easy lift. We have a great story. We have it is a great institution, full of great people. Obviously there's, we have our bad times and our, and bad things, within the institution, but, all in all, it's a phenomenal organization to be a part of. And it's really easy to kind of, you just go out and tell, stories about Marines, doing cool stuff, kind of. So I do want to say that you said, is it like journalism? You're never really going to, institutions can't police themselves in that regard, right? Like in journalism, we call it the fourth estate of our system of government, right? Journalists, the media, the press are have to serve the function of being a watchdog for democracy. You don't really get that, goal within the institution. It still has to come from outside. Right. So our job was to tell the Marine Corps story, be kind of PR representatives, if you will, for the Marine Corps. The military occupational specialty is public affairs. Actually, they've recently changed the name to something.
Rebellion, I'm sure.
It's like strategic communications and something that I just hate it. I don't know. But, it's like public affairs, and that's the job. But all the services have public affairs representatives, and it's your job. We also do things like facilitate media. So we do serve the function of when journalists need access or need to report stories about the military, right? Like we're the middle person, basically. We're the ones who take those queries and requests and also facilitate that access. We pride ourselves on that, on being like, hey, this is something that has to happen. So there's that factor. And then we also have a, community relations function as well.
So like win the hearts and minds kind of a mission?
Not so much downrange. That's more of a civil affairs is the MOS for that. I believe the Army mainly has that job. More on the domestic side. An example would be like the Marine Corps Recruit Depots have a program where they bring educators from all over the country to the recruit depots to kind of observe and experience a little bit. They get a little like, let's put you through the grinder and show you what it's like to be a new recruit. They do a little bit of stress on the teachers and stuff, but they basically pulling the curtain back, like, hey, this is what goes on here. So those are kind of fall under the community relations umbrella. Things like that.
So you're a storyteller is what you are as a journalist. I mean, you're conveying stories, and you learned to craft these stories by crafting narratives about the Marine Corps. So telling the Marine Corps story, that's how you learned to tell stories, to be a storyteller. It's fair to say, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead. So when you left, you decided you wanted, so you'd been doing this in the military, you've been telling these stories and crafting these narratives, and you've had an aptitude for it. It was something that you wanted to continue doing. And then you went to graduate school or to undergraduate school, undergrad after the Army after the Marine Corps?
Yeah. So actually, I was really fortunate to get selected for the Department of Defense has a program called the Military Photojournalism Program. It's kind of the parentheses in front of it is the Advanced Military Photojournalism Program, because I don't want to get too technical for you, but when I initially trained in my job, I trained at the Defense Information School at Fort Meade, Maryland. That's where all public affairs, combat camera folks, our combat photographers, videographers, illustrators. Those are all MOSs that go to the Defense Information School. So I went through, back then they called it the basic journalist course. They've since moved away from the term journalist. But it was the basic journalist course, which is, teaches you the 3 month crash course in print journalism. And then I attended after that the basic broadcaster course, same thing, about a 3 month crash course in broadcast journalism. And then I went to, my first duty station was Marine Corps Recruit Depot San Diego, where I served at the base newspaper. Back when we had base newspapers, before the death of print, that was still a way that we communicated with our internal and external audiences. So I worked for the Chevron newspaper at Marine Corps Recruit Depot San Diego as a staff writer, and then became an editor. And and from there, I applied for. I left out the part where I went to. I went back to the schoolhouse and attended the intermediate photojournalism course, which was where I really grew to love photography because I became more comfortable with it. And that was where I learned about the Advanced Military Photojournalism Program, which I applied for shortly after and went off to that in July of 2004. It's at Syracuse University. So it's 10 months, two semesters at one of the best journalism schools in the country. And you're just knocking out, I think it's about 15 credits per term or so. So it's like a full load where you're just knocking out all of the higher level, class requirements for their major in photojournalism. I've heard it referred to, and it's kind of a simple way to describe it, as like the Top Gun for military photographers. The way they run the program is they send like a handful of people who have kind of proved themselves as capable photographers and storytellers. And the idea is that you go get trained up in all these like awesome, skills at this great school. And then you go, it's a train the trainer program. So you go back to a unit and you infect all the other, Marines or, airmen or whatever with the knowledge that you bring back from that. So the really cool part of that opportunity, is for one, as a high school dropout from the sticks in California, I never, ever, ever, ever in a million years would have been accepted to this prestigious, expensive private university in upstate New York to study journalism. So the DoD has an agreement with Syracuse that as long as you maintain a B average or above while you're there and complete the course, you can matriculate and finish your undergraduate degree from Syracuse.
Oh, wow.
So that's what I did after leaving Syracuse. I was stationed in Okinawa and then Los Angeles. And during that 6 or so years after leaving Syracuse, I chipped away at my undergraduate degree. By the time I got out of the Marine Corps in 2011, I had two semesters left on that, which I knocked those out and immediately went to grad school. Right, I applied for grad school that year and followed, went to University of Oregon and studied multimedia journalism in graduate school. started in 2012. So that was what brought me to Portland. We moved up here for grad school and fell in love and stayed here.
That sounds a lot like my academic career. I think my first class was at community college at Fort Lewis in Washington. And, I'm doing my assignments in the back of a Humvee. And it took me, I think it was 2014 or 2015 before I actually graduated. So it took me like, almost 18 years or something to chip away at it. So I feel you on that.
Yeah.
So can you tell me, how did you become, thing we have in common is we're both Tillman scholars. So we're affiliated with the Tillman Foundation. Can you tell me maybe just a little bit, just briefly what that is for people that aren't familiar and how you became affiliated with it? What led you there?
Yeah, dude, I can always talk about the Tillman Foundation. I can talk about it all day. Greatest veteran service organization in existence, in my not so humble opinion. Indulge me for a second, because I was a massive fan and follower of Pat Tillman's life and legacy before the foundation was ever existed or I came to know about it. And so, in 2012, 13, when I was in grad school, I came across this, this scholarship opportunity. You're looking for scholarships to, supplement your meager income when you're living on the GI Bill, you know, and all that. So found the Tillman Foundation and applied, and was really blessed to win that scholarship, to be accepted as a Tillman Scholar. And I'll just say, the Tillman Foundation, you know, I like to joke that that it's a bit of a cult, you know, you know, I say that lovingly, because what it really is this amazing network of like really driven professionals, you know, who are military veterans and spouses of military veterans, and who are just like, you know, just want to do you know, amazing stuff, want to further their education so that they can do amazing stuff and give back to their communities and their country, and just, you know, people in general. That's, I think, one of the, you know, that's one of the central bedrock values of the foundation, is to kind of follow Pat's example of service, you know, and so, yeah, I was, you know, like I said, ecstatic to get accepted and be a part of this organization. We have this thing that I'm guessing you probably heard by now, but we love to talk about what we call the shame spiral, which is, you know, one of our scholars kind of coined this a few years back, about 5 years ago or so, at the annual Pat Tillman Leadership Summit, which usually takes place in Chicago. COVID killed it this year, but you know, yeah. So, but you know, we were all a bunch of Tillman alums were in a room and kind of just talking, you know, banging ideas around and talking about, you know, different issues. And somebody said, you know, what I love about this organization is you come here, and the guy was like a former Air Force pilot who was in med school. Right. And you get, you know, and, so he's going to be a doctor. And he's like, what I love about this organization is, you know, like, when you come to the summit, you know, you'll be like, you know, mingling with people, meet new people, and people asking, you'll be like, you know, well, yeah, I'm a former fighter pilot, and now I'm studying to be a doctor, you know. And he's like, this is like the only place where people will be like, and, you know, like, because we've got guys like Johnny Kim is, you know, is like, you know, Silver Star recipient, Navy SEAL sniper, corpsman, you know, Harvard educated doctor, now an astronaut, right? We just have, and there's just people in, there's like social workers, there's healthcare, you know, there's a small, tiny number of media folks like me, you know, and honestly, you know, like I wouldn't put us out in front either, but there's people who are just doing absolutely amazing stuff as business entrepreneurs, nonprofit, in the nonprofit sector, you know, all over the place. And, you know, so when you go in that environment, you get around people who are like-minded in the same way that, in the way that they're driven, to achieve and to serve, man, it's just an amazing feeling. You always leave that place just completely recharged. And, you know, and then I'm sure you've seen, you know, like, we get to see, you know, our Tillman brothers and sisters doing amazing stuff, serving the nation, serving their communities. And it's absolutely awesome, man. So can't say enough good things about it. If you're a military veteran or dependent, I think, is it just spouses, or is it
spouses?
Yeah. So, you know, military veteran or spouse of a veteran, absolutely apply. It's a phenomenal organization.
And they provide the financial support. So for me, that was huge to begin with. So like, I could afford an apartment and not sleep in my office when I was in the city for classes as a grad, you know, I was living in my office basically until I got that. So it gave me like a cushion with the money. But the big thing is this network that you talk about. Like, they're already, I've met people and had experiences that I never would have had if I hadn't been a part of this network. And then seeing them on a regular basis and interacting with them on a regular basis, it's like you said, it's this recharging experience where you see these people who are, I don't know how they do what they do. So you feel like, well, shit, the next time I show up here, I better have done something with my time. Like, you know, like, there's this, like, I feel like, an obligation to live up to the expectations that are, like, there's, and you're held accountable, not in this sort of formal way, but by being a member of this community, I feel an obligation to do something productive and to contribute in a meaningful way. And if I don't, I feel like I let everyone down. So I think it really does push the work forward that everyone's doing. It's, and if anyone's looking for an organization to become affiliated with in any way, I would highly recommend it.
And you know, it's funny that I buried the lead. Thank you for explaining that the main service, the thing that the foundation exists for, is to provide generous scholarships to to people who are pursuing higher education, so that they can focus their full attention on that pursuit. I will say, if you're watching this, and you're not. You're not one who is, going into college anytime soon, or you're not anybody who's going to be eligible. Please consider donating to the foundation, because their mission is incredible. Our leadership, Marie Tillman is the founder, and she's just an absolutely incredible human being. And so her leadership and all of our core leadership within the organization, absolutely outstanding, great group of people. You can guarantee that if you donate to the Tillman Foundation, your money is going to a great cause. So
great. Well said. So today we're going to talk. We have a little idea about your background. You had an interesting experience recently. I'm involved, I study policing. I was talking about policing. So CHAZ or the CHOP has been, a subject matter. Everyone's got questions. Everyone has an opinion. And you, as a journalist, went there. You spent a couple of days. You interviewed people, spoke with people, took photographs, got a feel for the place. And you've been up there a few times, I believe. Is that correct?
I actually just went up there just for one weekend. Okay. It was June 12th and 13th. I was there. Yeah.
Okay. So I know it was a couple of days. I wasn't sure if there was another trip. What was it that drew you up there? What was there something in particular about what was happening, or what was it that fascinated you with it?
Well, I'll start by saying I've covered protests, in Portland, a lot in the past. In fact, a few days before I went to Seattle on June 7th, I covered the protests in Portland, which have been ongoing since the George Floyd news, video broke, and it's been pretty much nonstop. In fact, Portland is kind of in a lot of ways an epicenter right now, and it tends to be. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like protest, highly progressive culture of Portland. It tends to be this place that, the protest movement is big here. And I think it's fair to say that I've covered the same people and organizations that were up in the CHAZ. I don't mean the exact same people, but I mean, you can kind of group them under the same ideology, And I certainly, having covered that firsthand and to be there on the ground and to see what it's actually like on the ground compared to media narratives, is always, for me, that's always something that's, that can be kind of frustrating, cause you want other people to have the same kind of perspective you have, and they don't, because that's just, it is a weakness of the media, that you can't cover every aspect and every angle, like some journalists are better than others in the depth of their coverage. But long story short is that with everything that was going on, it was definitely important to me to be able to see firsthand what was happening there if I wanted to report on it. Because we do, at Coffee or Die, and I think, the digital media landscape these days in general, you do have to do, some purely secondhand reporting, right? Like sometimes it's like, we would like, this is a topic our audience, is going to be interested in, and we want to serve our audience by reporting on it. but we can't put boots on the ground in, you know, wherever that's happening, right? So you have to rely on secondhand sources, you know, other outlets, you know, or you have to rely on picking up the phone, you know. But the best, you know, the best reporting that you can get, obviously, is boots on the ground, firsthand reporting. And so, you know, my boss called me up, like right before I went up there, basically, and was like, "Hey, have you been tracking this?" And I at the time, I said, "Not really, honestly, you know." He's like, "Well, you know, basically, the protesters took over the East Precinct and have established what they're calling an autonomous zone. Are you interested, you know, in going up there?" I gotta stop making this thing shake.
It's okay.
Are you interested in going up there? And, you know, it was like, absolutely, definitely, you know, I definitely wanted to go. And so, you know, we actually had a travel ban with our company, just like a lot of folks, with the COVID stuff going on right now and everything. So I had to get higher approval authorization for me to jump in the car and drive up there. But as soon as we got it, I headed up there, and my boss linked me up with one of Black Rifle Coffee Company's employees, which is the parent company of Coffee or Die, the online lifestyle magazine that I write and edit for. We haven't had an employee who is a Washington National Guard soldier. And who was on the front lines when the precinct, he was kind of, you know, supporting the police when they were clashing with protesters out in front of the precinct. And he was actually, helped secure it right before the mayor of Seattle told him to abandon it, told the police to let it go, which was a very controversial decision. The police chief, right. You know, didn't like that, if you know the background. And so, you know, it was like, "Hey, go up there, meet up with Tier. That's National Guard soldier. He's going to tell you his story and show you around, because he's also a Seattle native." So that's what I did. Just headed up there and, met up with Tier. And, as you read in the piece, I also called a Tillman brother of mine, named Chris, who is a he and I served in the same infantry regiment in the Army, and hit it off at the Tillman Summit 1 year. And he's a lawyer now, and he was up in Seattle. He's also lives in Seattle. So I said, "Hey, man, you want to go walk around the Chaz with me and watch my back?" And he was like, "Yeah, dude, let's do it." So
yeah, it's a good idea if you're going into someplace you're not familiar with your surroundings and you don't know, you know, what the security situation is. That totally makes sense. You got an assignment, you have a contact up there, you hook up with one of your Tillman Scholar friends, one of your brothers, and you watch each other's back, and then you talk to somebody on the way up. You make a little detour, talk to an old friend. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I had like a 3-hour drive, and I've got a lot of friends on both sides of the political spectrum. And I knew that, you know, just based on previous experience, my expectation was that whatever reporting was coming out of the media was incomplete. Basically. And, I had seen some pretty hyperbolic stuff on which I wrote about in the essay, on the right wing.
Like, I should have said this, the article will be in the description below on any platform you're on. So you can go read it yourself. Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. So long story short is I to put it bluntly, I knew there was propaganda coming out of that story, you know, coming out of the Chaz. And so I called up some of, you know, my more, what's the word, imaginative friends on the right. One of them especially, you know, just was like, you know, "Hey, man, you know, I'm just letting you know I'm going up here. You know, I'm gonna get the straight story, and I'll report back." You know, it was kind of the intent and the reason for calling. You know, I'm always kind of trying to help this individual, have a more balanced media diet than he does. And what I mean by that is he consumes a lot of, you know, right wing, frankly, propaganda. And so I was like going up here, and I'm gonna tell it how it is, and and so I mean, I won't recount the whole conversation, but there's he had some ideas, and I knew that they were probably off a little bit, or I suspected they were probably off. And I mean, that's really the gist of it, is just, I just kind of gave him a call. And the reason I put that in the story, the reason I included that conversation and that, I guess, dynamic in the story, was because I wanted to show that there's this kind of,
Similarity, like, sorry.
yeah, it, well,
Continue.
this anger and paranoia and frankly animosity for, American institutions, coming from both sides of the political, both, far sides of the political spectrum, it is like a friend of mine always likes to say, and I don't know if this is, where this quote originates from really, but, if you go far enough left or far enough right, you're gonna hit the other one. It's like the far left and the far right are indistinguishable, oftentimes, they might have some different, different policy priorities, but really it's like their extremism, and frankly authoritarianism, kind of tend to unite,
And
so.
I think that one of the things that I really got from reading it was the same sense that you talked about, this like distrust, this lack of trust in the institutions, American institutions, and American institutions to fairly arbitrate disputes and solve problems for people. And how when you describe it, it's like you can just see sort of mirrors of one another of the people you talk to once you head into the Chaz. So you get so you on the way up, you stop, you talk with this old friend, you get a sort of a feel for the messages, the stories that are coming out of there from his perspective. You've also seen some stories from other perspectives, so you have sort of this idea that there's something else happening here. It's probably somewhere in the middle and much more complicated than anyone's saying. And when you get there, the first thing one of the first things that I took note of was this, you're a photojournalist. You have a love of photography, and you're entering this zone where your right to photograph is. Can you just talk about that, the signs and
Yeah,
that experience?
absolutely. That was certainly something that stuck out right away. Because you and I talked a little bit offline before, and as I'm proud to say that I am a radical when it comes to free speech, right? Like, and that's because I know how important that is, right? That institution is to a free society and democracy, right? And of course, I've been, that's been beaten into my head in journalism school and throughout my career, right? So I've certainly drunk the Kool-Aid, so to speak, on free speech, a very hardcore libertarian kind of perspective on free speech. And I'm not ashamed of that at all. I think that our founding fathers, shared that impulse, right? And I think that our courts and government has, for the most part, done a really good job of maintaining that freedom, right? There's very few restrictions on speech in the United States and in Western liberal democracies in general, hopefully. And that's as it should be. I will say that I absolutely believe that a lot of these hard left movements, protest movements, they do not have that same fidelity to free speech. I'll try not to get too much in the weeds, but generally the whole cancel culture narrative and frame, I'm going to go on the record and say it's absolutely a thing. It's absolutely a very concerning thing. The way that liberal democracy is supposed to work is, You let the offensive and aberrant ideas be expressed, and then you defeat them with better discourse and better ideas, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, you don't need to go punching Nazis, in my opinion, because Nazi ideology is so far nutsoid, like out of alignment or out of tune with you know, American society, you know, and our ideals and our beliefs and the rights and you know that we have enshrined in the Constitution. So you know it's like I'm one who believes you let the Nazis have their marches and say their crazy business, man, and like, you know, let their ideas, you know, like fizzle with a, you know, with whatever. I don't believe that you need to go, you know, that you need to go suppress that speech with violence. I think that that speech will kill itself just by being a bad idea.
What about the suppression? I know we're talking recently. There's been like there was an article in Harper's, and then the lead editorial director at the New York Times, Barry Weiss, just resigned, and it centers right. around this idea of cancel culture, but not so much a threat of violence as public shaming and threats of maybe losing your job. There are these there are like private institutions that are restricting speech. It's not the state. So there's this, I tend to believe that this is highly problematic. Like, I want my writers and intellectuals to say all kinds of crazy shit because I think like an exchange of ideas is valuable. So how do you feel about when it's not a threat of violence, it's not the state, but it's private individuals canceling by ostracizing or maybe denying people employment, that sort of thing?
It's tough, man. It's definitely it's a tricky question. I want to say that I was focusing on the suppression through violence because I've seen that in the protest mm-hmm. movements, right? Like on the ground. As you know, there's moments in the essay that, you know, I certainly didn't, you know, experience violence against me, but it was definitely coercion to shut your freaking camera off, buddy, right. Or else, you know. So that was why I was kind of focused on, you know, the punching Nazis frame. But yeah, absolutely. I think it's a bigger issue. You know, that cancel culture is bigger than just violence, right? It is, you know, this kind of like groupthink dogma of, you know, like if you step out of line, you will be publicly ostracized, tarred and feathered, and relegated to the margins, you know? Like the Barry Weiss thing and the Harper's letter is a good example, right? Like, man, when I saw that Tom Cotton op-ed drop, you know, like I was like, I was very surprised to see the, you know, the gray lady publishing that on, you know, on their editorial page. And whether or not I agreed with it, though, you know, like, you know, that to me, it's like the whole issue is like, well, you can't publish that in the New York Times. You know, that was the great sin. It's not that somebody published it, right? Because, you know, Tom Cotton is a U.S. senator and he can say whatever he wants. You know, that, again, free speech, right? So that thing was going to get published somewhere. You know, the New York Times picked it up. You know, should that editor have, you know, published it? You know, who knows? Was it a fireable offense? Not. You know, not from my perspective personally. And, you know, honestly, I'll just say that I think that you let people you disagree with and oppose say their piece, and then you defeat them with better ideas and better rhetoric and better speech. You know, that's always where I'm coming from. This conflation of speech with violence, right? That's the thing, right? Now is like, well, you know, it's kind of like almost like a lawyer move, right? It's like, well, if one of the exceptions to speech is where you're actually putting someone in danger, right? Like yelling fire in a theater, right? Is like the common frame that everybody always cites, and it's actually not that simple. But I won't get into that. But if it's like if a way that you can suppress or chill speech is by proving, you know, someone's health and welfare, you know, is threatened by it, right? You know, then let's say that speech is violence. And that, you know, there's a great, I'll go on the record and say, recommend the book by Jonathan Haidt or Haidt. It's H-A-I-D-T, you know, academic from NYU. I forget the co-author of the book, but the book is called The Coddling of the American Mind. And, you know, Haidt and his co-author, they kind of try to you know, put a theoretical framework to, you know, the evolution, the rise and evolution of cancel culture, right? And, you know, if you're hard left, you know, and I believe Haidt was one of the signatories on the Harper's letter. So, you know, when I read that book, you know, I shared it and promoted it and was like, this is a great read, you know, it's like captures what's going on, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, I have a lot of hard left friends, you know, and they, you know, responded to it how I honestly expect, which is like, you know, like he's, you know, he's a hack, you know, it's like, you know, kind of attack the character. He's actually a really good academic, you know, he's written a lot of great books, done a lot of great research, and you know, but when he put that book out, he was immediately like ostracized from the kind of hard left, because it's like, you know, no, you know, you shouldn't be talking about this. I think I recommend that book, Coddling of the American Mind. You know, I think it may not be a, you know, a perfect theory, you know, but what theory is, especially in social science. So I think it's a valuable read and something to consider, you know, and something to weigh. So
you talk about, you also touch back on that, the idea of violence and the photography. It sounded like, so no one put hand, no one assaulted you, the story, no one assaulted you, but there was a couple of moments where, is it fair to say that you felt as though that you no longer felt, well, you say it pretty much, that you no longer felt safe and that you felt as though you could be harmed if you stayed with your camera? Is that fair to say?
Well, so, okay. I don't know if I would characterize it like in the essay, I deliberately used the line, this is no longer a safe space, right? And I was deliberately appropriating the language of, you know, of a lot of these folks in cancel culture. The safe space idea originated with like Roxane Gay, if I'm not mistaken, you know. And it's not a nefarious idea in and of itself necessarily, right? It's like the idea is like, you know, hey, like let's be a more inclusive culture and be cognizant of you know, where everyone's coming from and try to make safe spaces. Right. And so anyway, I don't want to go on a tangent there, but it was important to me to kind of make that connection that like, you know, okay, where is the line drawn of that like safe space idea? You know, it's really drawn where it's always been drawn in human society and civilization. It's the us and them dynamic, right? Like any anthropologist will tell you that, like, you know, that, you know, what makes us the dominant species on the planet is our capacity for cooperation and our ability to build communities that, and, you know, like groups of individuals who coalesce around, you know, a culture of reciprocity, right? Like I have your back and you have my back. We're going to hunt mammoths together, you know, like whatever, right? And so, same thing happens in the CHOP and the CHAZ, right? It's like, if you're one of us, like we're all good. If you're one of them, you're one of them, not so much. And you need to leave the borders, you know, and you're excommunicated or you're sent away. And so I want to say that, I didn't feel threatened, like I didn't feel like I was going to be the victim of violence, but that was because I knew not to push too hard. You know what I mean?
Right.
I knew that I didn't want to be the guy trying to provoke something so that I could then write about it. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and also, you know, to some extent, there's a little bit of legitimacy to this idea that, like, when you're in our house, these are our rules. There, and I say there's a little bit of legitimacy in that. I believe that if usually you have a constitution or laws, you know, like that are codified, right? That everybody knows beforehand and agrees to, right? That's society. You know, in the Chaz, it's like you're building that as you go, you know, and it's always this direct democracy kind of like, hey, who's in the immediate vicinity? Let's vote on mm-hmm. on what should happen right now, you know? And it's like, that's one of the things that was like frustrating about the whole context to me is like, you know, these folks have this idea that they're like reinventing society from the ground up. And it's like, you have millennia of human experience where people have done this over and over again, you know, and that's what government is. That's what social contracts are, you know? So anyway, I digress a little bit. I didn't feel threatened, but I also recognize the fact that the Chaz is no different than any government, whether it's local, state, or federal. It is always, you know, the rules are always backed by violence in society, right?
Yeah.
Fundamentally, underlying everything is the threat of violence, right? You know, hopefully it's like you have civilized society, we have the rule of law, you know, and it's like you publish the codes and, you know, you have the social etiquette and all that, and that, you know, that everybody agrees on, and hopefully, and you follow that. And that's what culture is. It's like an expectation of certain behaviors from the people around you, you know? And so, you know, knowing that, like, that violence is always, you know, the underlying factor that enforces the rules, you know, I certainly didn't want to get to that point. So I kind of let it, you know, I kind of like waited to see, you know, what was happening, which is like, you know, people like swarmed me immediately, you know, it was like as soon as the leader kind of pointed, like, you know, we've asked people not to shoot, and this guy is still shooting right in front of me, sir. You know, like, you know, please no cameras or this and that. Yep. And man, like it just took a second. Like there was this like blonde woman and she had a face covering, looked kind of like in a cab, or I don't know if Naqib, I apologize if I'm messing up the pronunciation of that, but you know, like, Islamic kind of, face covering. And, the hijab is actually different because it doesn't cover the face, right?
Okay, I got you.
It's actually covering the face. I think it's a niqab. Oh, okay. I apologize for being it. But anyway, she just like jumped up and immediately was like, you know, oh, you know, like, I got you, man. Like, I'm going to make you put that camera away. And she was just like up in my face, like right away. And then other people like closed in, you know, maybe not as like aggressively, but closed in. She was just like pushing on my camera. I said, you know, please don't touch my camera, you know? And it was this whole, the group decided, bro, you know, like it was a Democrat. She kept saying it was a Democratic decision. And that Democratic decision, you know, that it was literally like, it is direct democracy, right? It's the leader. This guy ain't one of us, and he ain't doing what we want. Who thinks that we should you know, he should conform or he should comply, you know? And of course, you know, there's all these kids, frankly, you know, a lot of really young people, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, like whatever that guy said, you know, you know, and I don't mind being, you know, being a little offensive here, you know, it's totally total groupthink scenario, you know, it's like nobody's ever going to be like, well, I don't want to, you know, in that context, you know, like you're not going to speak up and be like, well, actually, I think, you know, like you're nobody, you're just the white college kid who showed up to the People's Assembly in the Black Lives Matter protest. You know, like, who are you to disagree that we shouldn't, you know, suppress speech or, you know, like, you know, make this guy turn off his camera. So anyway, sorry, I feel like I'm rambling here, but
that reminded, in the piece you talk about that, you say it reminded you of like of James Madison and this idea, you know, of the tyranny of the majority. And did you feel, you felt that present, that sort of phenomena present there?
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about ethics. I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, metaphysics and epistemology. I like, you know, I'm a glutton for punishment, so I like reading, you know, philosophy. And I'll say that, you know, where we draw the lines of liberty, you know, we talk about in our Pledge of Allegiance in the United States, we have this line, liberty and justice for all, right? And it's so simple, right? It's like such a simple concept. You know, of course, liberty and justice for all. Like, who doesn't agree with that? And the thing is that if you actually like get into the weeds and really, really dig in, you find that like liberty and justice are often opposing objectives, you know? And so it's really much more complex than that. And so I spend a lot of time, you know, reading about and thinking about and discussing and you know, what we talk about when we talk about liberty and justice, right? I'll just give a shout out real quick and say that one of my favorite, you know, essays on political philosophy is, was it Two Concepts of Liberty by Isaiah Berlin? I highly recommend it to anyone. It's a dense read, but it is a phenomenal read. The guy basically takes like, you know, every great thinker, you know, for centuries who has ever had an idea about liberty, whether it's John Stuart Mill or Karl Marx or, you know, it's just like, you name it, you know, and he kind of discusses these two different concepts of positive and negative liberty, right? And I won't try to summarize it in effectively here. It's just a great essay that takes a while to get through, but I recommend it to anyone who's interested in this topic. You mentioned Madison. Yeah, it was. I had thought many times in the past about this concept of the tyranny of the majority. You know, and it's like, well, you know, is it, you know, and when I say thought about it, I'm thinking like of its validity and value, you know, and or the merits of it, you know. And man, I had never in my life had it so poignantly illustrated to me than that moment where you literally have this tyranny of a majority in a direct democracy, supposedly, setting, you know, where it's just like there's no like appeals court or arbitration. It's just like, listen, frankly, to put it frankly, it's you know, really, but you know, if you cut to the chase, it's like, listen, do what we say, we're gonna fuck you up.
Basically, right.
that's what's really underlying that, and that, I think that's what's kind of scary and concerning to me about not just this movement, but I think there's you know, the same thing on the right too, but it's the fact that I think that. All of us, I tend to believe that all of us are capable of great evil in certain circumstances. You know, put someone in the right context and they will recede to, you know, a really awful thing, basically. You know, I think you know, I think that the simple way that some people will frame it is like there's a little bit of Hitler in all of us. You know, you just got to put us in the right situation, and knowing, you know, believing that, or I would say knowing that about human nature, I'm very skeptical of you know, human frailty and frailty is not the right word, but you know, our capacity to do awful things to other people in the name of justice or freedom or whatever, you know.
It kind of reminds me of I lived in China for a few years, for about 3 years. My wife and I, and we had our kids, and we moved over there. I was trying to learn Chinese, and got to, I can I say I had deeper relationships with my neighbors there than I ever have in the United States. It's very, in the evenings, everyone goes outside, everyone's having conversations, everyone knows their neighbors, and like it's a very different sort of feel than modern American society. And so we got to know quite a few people, and people didn't talk about it a lot, but some of the older folks, I got to hear some stories about the Cultural Revolution in China, and just young people sort of taking over, and this arbitrary sort of no appeals, no questioning. You're going to the countryside. Your life is completely turned upside down and changed. And it's because the people want this. It's the people's will. So it's and to think that thing, something like that, maybe in a different form, couldn't happen here. We're no different than anyone else. Like, I don't think that we should,
Well, I tend to, I mean, I'm a student of history. I think it's vital to, I think all of us as citizens in a democracy, should be students of history. And because, like what we're, I think what we're seeing now, the same pattern has played out in so many countries and or nation states throughout history, right? You can trace it to, I mean, I would say the current context of things are analogous to, or could be analogous to, right? Like pre-French Revolution, right? And like if you know your history of the French Revolution, it didn't go so well. Like after they started cutting people's heads off, it didn't go so well for freedom,
No.
you know. And then there's like the Bolshevik Revolution, in Russia and everything. And like you mentioned the Cultural Revolution in China. And so this is what happens when people lose faith in the institutions of power that constitute your society, right? And so you're seeing that. That's kind of one of the main themes in my essay, right? You're seeing that on both sides of the political spectrum. People on the left feel very, disillusioned and attacked by myriad, forces and factors and very different motivations and perspectives on the right, but same kind of thing. It's like this system isn't working for me, is kind of the thing. And so what tends to happen, historically is this when people feel that way, when the populace feels like the system isn't working for them, they're not really interested in incremental reforms anymore. They're not really interested in listening to like, okay, we can fix this, like let's do it through the system politically. It becomes this thing where it's like, kind of the, to borrow, from China, right? The great leap forward, and that's, it's not the same thing as the Cultural Revolution, but, there's this impulse that if we use violence or we use, if we use bloody revolution, if we kill the masters, we'll build the utopian dream now, or a lot faster than it would take to do it through the existing institutions, and so that's where we are, I
You
think.
see, you
We're
say
in that.
that the line you just used, the kill the masters, you saw that written while you were there. Can you just talk about that? It's from an HBO series. Can you just tell why that's significant?
Yeah, if I mean, I'm sure Game of Thrones is one of the most, popular TV shows of all time, I'm pretty sure. So a lot of people probably know, but is it Daenerys Targaryen, one of the, the main characters, a great, matriarch, leader, and emperor, right? That's one of the stories in the show. Yeah, I think probably like 4 or 5 seasons in, where she basically frees a slave society, and in the process, turns the slaves against the masters, like basically go slaughter the masters, like go murder the masters. And of course, the slaves who are, they're not just slaves, they are slaves who were raised from birth to be warriors, are like, hell yeah, and they, gladly and gleefully go, go murder all, slay all the masters. And in the Chaz, of course, being full of a lot of, revolutionary and idealistic young people who watch Game of Thrones, that was one of the tags on this. It was this perfect monument to tag it on was this thing. It looks like a, almost like a pyramid, it was like kind of a, looks like the top of a cone kind of, and the, the top's flat though. So you can like, it's at an angle where you can climb up, this, the bricks to the top and sit on this nice thing. And it's like, you're on this, you're on the top of this, pyramid-like structure. And it says, tag at the bottom is like, kill the masters. And I think I have a photo in the essay, like there's a kid just sitting there, looks like a, your basic hipster white kid, he's got his Black Lives Matter shirt sitting at the top, just like enjoying a sunny day. But yeah, it was, it, and it was so like the juxtaposition of that was so fascinating to me because as this, as the show goes on, the evolution of that character is, it's kind of a classic trope that so many people today hated, right? Which I actually liked. This classic trope that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? And so that character who's supposed to be like the one who defies the trend and is becomes the like truly benevolent, dictator, or like leader of all the seven kingdoms in the show. It doesn't quite go that way. And the power does go to her head, and she ends up becoming exactly what she, has always purported to rail against, and that's a tyrant, basically a murderous tyrant. And so that to me was like, it's like, there's no, the people who tagged that certainly didn't make that connection probably, right? They're just like, kill the
No.
master. It's a great meme, And for me, it was like, this is scarily similar, in like the lack of recognition that the consolidation of power, no matter whose power it is, always goes awry, it always has to be checked. So anyway,
Yeah,
yeah.
I thought it was fascinating, and it was just like perfect that that they would pick that given what you were seeing. You talk about, just to touch on history again, you, and I'm sorry to take so much of your time. I'll try to take too much of it up,
No,
but
we're good, man. I'm good.
you talk about the Paris Commune and how when I saw this emerging, it reminded me of that as well. How this there's this like experiment that emerges, and it's out of a period of history where people may feel dislodged from their mooring. Like the Industrial Revolution has descended upon Europe, and there's all these social changes, and thing the world has fundamentally changed, and people feel disenfranchised, disconnected, and lacking in power. And you do you see that today? Do you see the similarities there? You kind of touch on that.
I do, and I mean, this my perception is that what's happening in our society right now is that minority groups who have been pushed to the margins of society, right, or they perceive that they, that they're pushed to the margins, they're basically, they've been calling for and demanding change, right? And whether or not, I don't want to get into, I'm sure there will be people who will listen to this, and I have friends on the right, like the guy in the essay, Will, who referred to as Will. I have friends on the right who will just, I mean, they will just say, like, institutional racism is a myth created by the media, by the liberal media. Or pick your poison of like whatever kind of progressive objective, you know, is being pushed, you know, and they'll tell you that's all, you know, it's all BS, you know, kind of pushed by the media. And of course it's, you know, it's never that simple. Right. And it's sad to me that anyone, whether you're on the right or the left, thinks it's that simple, you know? And so I think what we're seeing is, you know, basically you've got a lot of left movements who are like, we're not going to take it anymore. You know, we want it all right now, you know? And I think, you know, frankly, I think, I'm like parsing my words carefully here. I mean, I'll say it. You know, I think hopefully I don't get myself in trouble there, but I think, you know, Trumpism, right, a particular strain of American conservative right wing ideology, is this idea that it, in my mind, is this idea that it is as simple as, you know, bringing a hammer down on those groups and individuals and ideas, right? And it's this promise of like we'll return America to the good old days, where, you know, where there were no social problems and nobody ever stepped out of line and you know, threw, you know, rocks and other awful things at police, and, you know, I mean, and worse than that, obviously there has been, you know, police officers killed in these movements. I certainly acknowledge that there's absolutely violence coming from, you know, from some left factions. You know, I'm not, by no means do I mean to you know, pigeonhole the entire movement or all protesters, but there have certainly been people on both the right and the left exploiting this situation and using violence, you know, to as they believe promote their agenda. And so I digress, but the point is that Trumpism is a reaction to those movements, and it's, I do think that the like kind of like the hardcore, you know, as Trump put it, you know, like, let's dominate the battle space, or let's dominate these protesters, that kind of thing. I'm not one who, you know, I'm a big fan of Martin Luther King, and I'm not one who believes that that you can, you know, that you can fix these things with like hardcore violence and oppression, right? You know, there's that great Martin Luther King quote, you know, it's like, hate can't destroy hate, only love can do that, you know, that kind of thing. I tend to believe that this has to come from truly civil discourse and the willingness to listen to each other. And there's one thing that I didn't really get to that I wish I would have included in the essay, but I just kind of didn't fit, so to speak. But an idea that I wanted to talk about and share is that one of the things that they had set up in the Chaz was this place called the Conversation Cafe. And, you know, they had sign, it was a bunch of like couches out in the middle of the intersection, you know, like by the, near the East Precinct, you know, and kind of like cordoned a little bit. And it was just a place where people were encouraged to, you know, it looked like an old, like a bunch of old, like beatniks, you know, like, you know, back in the day, drinking, you know, it was a place where people were encouraged to have conversations about anti-racism. You know, that was like especially the thing that people should be talking about. And you know, absolutely, like, we need to be listening to each other more. We need to be empathizing with, you know, or willing to empathize with people's experiences and where they're coming from more. And that was certainly the objective of those conversation cafes. I will say that probably my assumption is that the people who are populating those cafes are probably already pretty progressive, you know, like folks in the first place. So it's like, they're probably just, you know, mostly agreeing with each other and maybe learning a little bit. And that's, and not denigrating it. I think it's great. But I think the people who really need to have those conversations are the people who are most unwilling to listen. So that's really sad to me, is that I see people on the right and the left who, you know, they're just like not having it. They're like, you know, the time for discourse is past. You know, let me dehumanize an other, everyone who I believe is my enemy, you know, and just, you know, ideologically opposed, you know, to the extent that I'm not going to even try to engage with them, you know. I think that's really sad. I think we need to have conversation cafes all over the place, and we all need to come to the table with humility and an open ear. And you know, Will, the guy I mentioned in the essay, you know, I didn't really want to get into this, but I'll say what I shared with you offline was just, you know, that individual will, I mean, he's very, very hard right. And that individual will in one breath say, you know, systemic institutional racism, you know, is a made up thing. It's, you know, it's not real. And they'll say stuff like, you know, they always have like, I have a black friend who validates that. And there's like black, you know, media personalities and vloggers. There's like,
a couple an industry, like, you know, it seems.
There's a high demand for, you know, black folks to take up the mantle of, you know, systemic racism is a myth, you know? But I have friends who will say, you know, they'll vehemently, you know, like just passionately and angrily say, oh, you know, this is such garbage, you know, it's all made up, right? In the next breath, that same individual is literally using racial epithets like the N-word. And, you know, and in that conversation, in the conversation I'm referencing, I pointed that out to him. I was like, dude, are you capable of seeing the cognitive dissonance in this statement and this statement, right? Like, you're saying there's no racism in America, systemic or otherwise, essentially, is your claim. You know, you as a, you know, straight white guy, you know, and then in this breath, you're throwing around the N-word like it doesn't carry the pain and, you know, anger and, you know, like it isn't loaded with absolute toxicity. Like it's just something that you can throw around casually, you know, because you're this privileged white guy, you know? And like, that's insane to me. It's insane to me that anyone can think like that, you know, that you can say, you know, nobody's racist. There's no racism in America. N-word, 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 you know? It's like, you know, buddy, I'm sorry, but you're racist. Mm-hmm. You know, like you cannot talk like that. That is racist, you know? And you know, I mean, I'm a free speech radical, you know, but that doesn't mean that, you know, I absolutely recognize, you know, civility. So there's a difference between what is legal and allowed by the state, you know, and what is right, you know, and that's a whole other can of worms, but generally, you know, if you're not willing to listen, if you don't have enough humility to ask questions about these groups and individuals that you don't understand, if you don't seek out like conflicting opinions and experiences, like I don't think you're doing enough. And frankly, I know those people, a lot of these people don't want, they have no interest in doing that work. A lot of them, frankly, and I've, you know, the guy I was talking to has told me overtly in some conversations, you know, I welcome civil war, you know, like they want to watch the world burn, mm-hmm. You know, that's where they're at is like, you know, those people on the right are at the same place that a lot of these folks on the left are, which is, you know, trying to talk it through ain't working. I'm ready to take up arms and start burning stuff, you know? And that's, it's really sad to me to see my country in that position. I really hope that something changes, that cooler heads can prevail going forward, and we can figure out a way to build a truly inclusive, truly liberal, I'm on a mission to
reclaim the term.
I'm on a mission to reclaim the word liberal. Okay, because our founding fathers, pretty liberal dudes, classical liberalism. Okay, John Locke, you can pretty much, is a guy you can kind of trace the political philosophy to, and those ideas are what the United States is founded on. So this notion that like liberalism and all liberals are bad or the enemy, and them is toxic and terrible, man. Because there's some valuable and good ideas on the left, and there's some valuable and good ideas on the right, and conservative and liberalism. And what makes us great is that we are a pluralistic society, and those ideas, sometimes they clash, sometimes they come together, and they form, hopefully they form a social contract that, everyone benefits from and is allowed to, to live as they, as they wish. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's my hope is that we do see more reforms to the point that, we kind of chip at least, in our ability to talk and hopefully build something. But man, I don't know. I think I tend to believe that we're in a bad way right now.
I do as well. I really worry about the level of violence and escalation, and then reaching a point where things could spiral out of control, and people, we seem to think that we're entitled to some type of stability, but we're not. This is, this happens to all societies periodically, and I worry the same could happen here. One thing I just wanted to touch on was, so I feel like we've all been stressing the negatives, but you talked a little bit about having the space where people can have conversations. You also talk about like going into a store and someone sort of open their space and providing bathroom services and people cleaning up. Can you just for a minute, just touch on some of the positive things that you saw while you were there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, what I saw, I said, there's a point in the essay where I said that some of it felt kind of performative. And what I meant by that was that everybody was on their best behavior, so to speak, trying to conceive and support and live out this kind of anarcho-communist ideal. And so what that requires is, anarcho-communism requires a hell of a lot of like cooperation, and then of course it requires this like equal distribution of goods, right? So everything has to be free, and everyone has to be down for the communitarian cause, and so that's what there was like, they call them rejuvenation stations, and there was all these places and some of the businesses, who had been closed down from COVID, and then like, Chaz comes along and they're like, well, we're already closed down, let's just like roll with this wave. And some of them were very supportive of the movement, maybe some less so. But yeah, there was just, you could go into, like, I went into a hair salon, and usually it's a hair salon. They had this table full of like free stuff, like Twix bars, granola bars, waters, bottles of water. And there were stations like that all over the place. Places like had masks and hand sanitizer and stuff. And there was people handing out free food, there was, sometimes at these places there was, hey, like, like if you want to help out, order pizzas and have them sent to this location or whatever. And so there was this attempt to to, you know, embody this, you know, Marxist ideal, you know? And as like my buddy Tier, the National Guard guy, who was, you know, as he put it, in the video that we produced, there was like a soundbite for him, you know, I was like, what do you think happens next? And he said, you know, I'm glad there's no violence. This is all really cool, but it's all supported by capitalism still, you know, I mean, when you follow the thread, it's still people who have salaries and, you know, whether, however they make that money, you know, they are still supporting it with their funds. So, you know, so it's the kind of thing that like, you know, how do you provide that context, you know, with a truly, I guess, Marxist economic system. You know, if you know history, it never has really gone that way. You know, and plenty of my hard left friends will be like, oh, well, you know, that's not the real communism, you know, like Stalinism, Maoism, you know, all the failed, you know, Marxist states throughout history, you know, that's never real communism. You know, it's always, you know, some iteration that went awry because of human nature, to which I always, you know, respond, that's kind of the point.
Yeah, no political experiment is ever immune from the forces of history or culture. Then there's always an opposition, you know, like it's, it never happens in a vacuum.
So to sum up what kind of the answer to your question, and I know I was kind of going these verbose directions, so I apologize, but the gist is that, you know, while I admire the spirit and I tried to capture it, you know, I've been to, you know, fest, I've never been, I compared the Chaz to Burning Man or somebody on the ground compared it to Burning Man. And, I've never been to Burning Man, but I've been to like similar kind of festival shows, you know, with a very hippie vibe and that kind of thing. You know, and so I've certainly seen this, and it's always this like very, you know, welcoming, positive environment. Right. And everybody's on that same wavelength, right? They're all, you know, they're all aspiring for the same, like, you know, good vibes. Right. And so while I love that and I admire it, it doesn't tend to play out that way on a larger, grander scale in social contracts, you know, and you need only look at history to see that. And that's the thing about social contracts and, you know, and free societies, is that they're not perfect. Never will be. There is no utopia. You know, like the best you can hope for is, you know, is constant improvement, you know, is doing your best to, you know, to be better, you know, it's like how I try to live my life as an individual, you know, is like, I think, you know, Socrates said something to the effect, that to know the good is to seek the good. Right. So you're never going to be like, you know, perfect or purely benevolent, you know, but if you wake up every day with the intent of pursuing virtue, trying to embody virtue and figuring out, you know, how, you know, and making that a value of yours and a priority of yours, then I think you're going to be a good person. That's what a good person is someone who aspires to be and works at it every day. And I think you can take that and apply it to government systems and social contracts too. We have a responsibility to, you know, to progress, right? And right. To grow, you know, as a people and as a nation. And, you know, as I put in the conclusion of the essay, you know, like, to meet our ideals, you know, to actually live up to our ideals. And that's, you know, what that looks like and where that, you know, that goal or that endpoint is, I guess, is never clear and easy, you know? So
I think that you're right on. And I think that to the solution to this, the way to move forward peacefully is for the people in power, positions of power and power and authority in our society to start the work of improving people's lives and convincing people that there is this ongoing effort to move forward and improve. And I think that in for the last several decades, working class people on both sides of the political spectrum, that's what I can speak to, but across a bunch of classes, have lost faith that the government and that the country is doing that for them. That's like, is doing that work that you talk about and improving. I feel like people have lost faith that improvement is happening. And I don't know how that trust is restored, but I think it's key. I want to let you go, but I wanted to ask you one more question if you have the time. And you just talk about you talked about how you end the story, but you also talk about an email, receiving an email. Can you just talk a little bit about that, how that happened, and maybe you could close up with those thoughts that were in the email? I thought it was
great. Yeah. Everybody, well, not everybody, but, when I turned in the draft for that, one of my editors was like, you got an email from Jim Mattis? Like, what, a little bit more, like, I need more context here. Like, how did that happen? I will out myself, as an unabashed, fan of Jim Mattis. You know, I served in the Marine Corps for 10 years. I don't know how many Marines I've met in my time in service. It's countless Marines I've met who either served with Jim Mattis or had, you know, some cross paths with him at some point. I've never met a single Marine who had an experience with Jim Mattis that did not have some story about how amazing and inspiring he was in that context, you know. And whether it was, I remember talking to like a recon Marine, who was like, I think it was like in the initial invasion of Iraq, and you know, Mattis like came out, you know, to the front lines and like, you know, visit him, and you know, he had this great story that I won't indulge right now, but you know, it was like this true battlefield leader, kind of a general or kind of an officer. I mean, the guy, if you look at the guy's resume, I mean, it just doesn't get, you know, more stellar as a military officer. He's absolutely a Marine's Marine, the kind of guy who very heavily feels the gravity of, you know, being a combat leader, you know, and sending Marines and service members into harm's way. And so he's the kind of leader that, you know, that enlisted guys like me love, because you trust him not to squander your well-being, right? You trust him, you know, that if he says we need to do this, if this is the plan, then it's a good plan, you know? And so anyway, that's my little, where I come from at Jim Mattis. But the way that I, you know, came to have a kind of occasional pen pal relationship with Jim Mattis, I guess you would say, is just, you know, being a journalist. I think it was like a few years back, I wrote an essay for American Legion magazine. It was called Commitment Issues, and it was kind of an essay analyzing American foreign policy post 9/11, counterinsurgency, which I kind of wish we would have gotten into a little bit here. But I think there, you know, I won't go into it, but I'll say I think there's some, there's some value to talking about, counterinsurgency doctrine and the parallels between like the policing situation in America today. I'll throw out a shout out to Alex Horton, who is a former Army infantryman, you know, served in Iraq, who now is a Washington Post reporter. He wrote a great piece a few years back, because this topic has been around for a while, right? About, you know, how being a grunt on the ground in Iraq, you know, the standard for the use of lethal force seems to be so much higher for soldiers in a combat environment than it does for American police. And the reasons for that are many and complex. You may be familiar with like the reasonable man standard, you know, and use of force doctrine and all that. And so we, I won't get into that, but Alex's point was, you know, look, we were held to this really high standard and this really high level of courage, you know, and moral courage was expected and required of soldiers downrange, you know, and he didn't frame it this way, but I would say that, you know, really the underlying message is like, why isn't that the case for American police? You know, why is the legal standard, if you look into it, the legal standard, and, you know, you can correct me on this, Tom, because you're more of a, you know, you have experience as a police officer, but the legal standard really is more of a like, you know, you can, as long as you have a reasonable, you know, concern for your own safety or that of others, you know, you can use lethal force, you can shoot someone. And when, you know, we really get into the minutia of it, you know, it's really hard to, you know, that's, I think that's part of something a lot of people miss. It's really hard to prosecute police officers who use deadly force. Even if, you know, like, you know, you as an observer are looking at it and like, man, that seems very cut and dry. Like he just murdered that person, you know, or, you know, that was, he didn't have to pull the trigger there, you know? And certainly there are cases where the videos that you see online don't tell the whole story and all that. But the main point I'm trying to make here is that it's very disconcerting to me that you have this like, you know, grunt in a combat zone who like you place so much gravity on him to do the right thing and put himself at higher risk, you know, to like let the situation play out a little bit more, you know, because it, as you know, with counterinsurgency doctrine, every time you make a bad kill, mm-hmm. right, every time you lose one of those hearts and minds. And this, and Jim Mattis and David Petraeus literally wrote the, you know, counterinsurgency doctrine, field manual, basically, you know, and that's one of the key components is that every time you screw up and, you know, kill a civilian, you know, that you didn't know at the time, but, you know, they were civilian, they were non-combatant, whatever, right? That takes you back, you know, it's like, you know, one step forward, like 8 steps back, you know, that's kind of the theory. And I mean, it's obviously clearly true. And you see that in the United States is, you know, when you have a George Floyd incident, right? I mean, there's a massive loss of, I mean, there's already a loss of faith in the institution of police in the United States that's been happening for a long time because, you know, it's more and more salient in the media and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, you see that every time this happens, that whole ACAB frame, all cops are bastards, is just reinforced. You know, I'm not saying all cops are bastards, but that is the, you know, that's the kind of, you know, it's like, that's how people feel right now. A lot of people feel right now is that you can't save the institution because, you know, cops are corrupt or whatever. And I'm just trying to make the analogy between, you know, that soldier requirement for use of force versus police. Police are absolutely, I think, you know, law enforcement is full of a lot of great leaders and courageous people. Okay. But I think it's worth like considering like what expectations do we have for that level of courage, right? The extent to which, you know, the idea that like if you're scared, shoot, you know, there's something wrong with that. And that's certainly not how it's, you know, it's trained, but the police are trained to this reasonable man standard, which basically says, you know, hey, if shit goes south and it, you know, it feels like you could be, you know, you could be killed or harmed, you know, you can take someone's life.
Absolutely. Those are the rules. And I think I think there's a disconnect because police officers, that's in their mind, that's how they see the world. And then citizens, they they just, it doesn't make sense to them, which is completely understandable. I don't know if moving forward that we're going to be able to operate with that same standard. I think that we may need to ask more, like you're saying. Like, I think that as societies become increasingly passive and as these things become more visible through in the media and it changes the technology, that we may need to ask for renegotiation of that social contract with police officers in terms of the rules of engagement, what risk they need to be willing to accept, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you may know this already, but you know, this isn't something that we like codified in legislation. It's actually the result of a Supreme Court precedent.
Yes.
You know, and it's very, there's a great podcast called More Perfect, produced by the guys who do Radiolab, if you ever listen to Radiolab. But it's More Perfect is a podcast where they basically tell the, like, get in the weeds and tell the kind of like detailed narrative behind a lot of landmark Supreme Court cases. And one of them is this reason, you know, where the reasonable man standard came from. And it's super ironic, man, because the court case came up from like a case of like, you know, excessive force and policing and whatnot. And they, I can't remember exact details, but basically the guy won the case, but that established this precedent that gave us the reasonable man standard, and that podcast is great because it gets into like that legacy, and it, you know, they interview some police trainers who, like, you know, talk about how they're like, yeah, we train to this standard, you know, like we teach cops that again, my wording, not necessarily his, you can shoot first and ask questions later, you know. And I think that's something that, you know, just like you said, we have to contend with that. We have to figure out, you know, how we, where the right standard is for police. I want to say, you know, I'm sure at this point, you know, if there's cops listening, or like, you know, people more conservative mindset listening, they're probably like, who is this, you know, freaking, you know, lefty or whatever. But I want to say, like, I absolutely acknowledge that being a cop on the street, right, is, you know, frankly, you know, especially, you know, depending on the environment, can be a deeply traumatizing job on a daily basis. I have a lot of friends who work in law enforcement, corrections. You know, like I said, I come from a little tiny town with a couple prisons, and you know, the stuff that these guys see on a daily basis, man, is like, is pretty intense. And they, and a lot of these guys carry, you know, post-traumatic stress or trauma around, you know, with them all the time. And so they're this like mistrust, the mirroring mistrust of the communities they serve, you know, is understandable, right? To a certain degree. It's like if you've had an encounter with, you know, one too many, you know, aggro individuals, you know, and you've been in those situations where you've feared for your personal safety or your life or whatever. I mean, it affects you, right? And so I think that there should be more recognition, you know, from the kind of anti-police movement, you know, that's a factor, that you know, these guys, police are human beings too, you know. And it's not as simple as this guy is a racist monster. No. Oftentimes, you know, there are certainly some racist monsters in law enforcement. I will say that, yeah, you know, sure. Like, I think we saw recently some cops in, like, I want to say like South Carolina or North Carolina were fired because they were talking about, you know, like, you know, N-word this and talking about a, you know, going out and, you know, killing black people in a civil war or something. So there are certainly people who legitimately fit that frame and that narrative. I don't think it's the majority. You know, I couldn't tell you what the percentage is. I think that that most cops are just, you know, carrying around a lot of, you know, a lot of trauma, man. Yeah. Like,
absolutely. So. I think one of the things is we have a major problem right now with law enforcement. The way that it's been structured and the way that it executes, it's the way that it operates in this country is, it's doesn't appear to be acceptable anymore, like that there needs to be dramatic change. But changing a, like engaging in systematic reforms where you, like the logical solution, like offload a big chunk of the workload, you know, from law enforcement, you know, like shore up our mental health system, provide people medical care, secure housing, job opportunities, training, education, daycare, prenatal nutrition. All of these things can be techniques and forms of statecraft that create a safer community. But to do that is very expensive, very challenging, very difficult. So it's much easier to just say, it's the cops. It's this one right. institution. It's, and even make it even simpler to say it isn't the cops. It's a few bad apples that are the cops. Yeah. But really, it's not a bad apple. It's not even a bad barrel. It's the entire orchard. The police are part of our society. They're something that are reflect who we are as a nation. So if we want to change policing, I think we need to change our entire. It needs to be a systemic change, and policing will change with the society is sort of my thinking.
Yeah. So I agree with you. I think, you know, there's some kind of, you know, pilot programs or like there's some initiatives, in several communities in the United States where they have tried to, you know, I think it was, I want to say it was like Houston or Dallas, had a, you know, a program where they married social workers, you know, they partnered social workers with law enforcement. And from what I understand, it's been fairly successful. And you know, I can kind of take this back to the counterinsurgency and the military analogy. Again, you know, if you look at, American military in the 21st century and the missions that we have to carry out, counterinsurgency especially, you know, it's like, man, you need a whole portfolio of skill sets to address that, right? Like anyone who's been deployed downrange to Iraq or Afghanistan, you know, trying to win hearts and minds, right? The Marine Corps was made to like blow shit up and kill, you know. And you know, in the 21st century, we're asked, I think they call it like fourth generation warfare, you know, like the counterinsurgency doctrine. We're asked to go like, you know, holster that impulse and be humanitarians. And it's like, so fundamentally there's like right off the bat, man, it's like there's a disconnect there. But the point I'm making is that, you know, in that context, you know, the grunt often isn't the most valuable guy on the battlefield. You know, sometimes it's those civil affairs teams or that public affairs, you know, detachment, you know, telling the story, or, you know, information operations, which is, you know, military speak for propaganda, you know, or influence operations. So, you know, in my mind, it's like, I don't think that, domestic U.S. is totally analogous to like, you know, rural Afghanistan, you know, where the Taliban, you know, kind of reigns. But the needs are similar in that you have to have a diversity of skill sets, right? So I think there's absolutely a need to evolve policing, and I think that's something that a lot of people agree on and recognize. I think where it gets difficult and the point of contention is that like law enforcement agencies are often so tied up they're driven by fiscal needs, right? Ferguson is a perfect example. Like, wherever you stand on, you know, Michael Brown's killing and that whole thing, you know, whatever brought that about, that's not important. One of the results of that was that the Justice Department did an in-depth investigation of the Ferguson Police Department, right? And what was one of the things they found? They found that Ferguson PD operated like a lot of PDs do, which is, you know, a revenue generating, organization more so than a protect and serve organization, right? And that's always going to be a factor. Is that, it's so easy for politicians to use the police as a way of like squeezing money out of the community, and oftentimes it's like very conservative politicians who are like low taxes and low taxes and law and order. The two go hand in hand, bro. Oftentimes, right? It's like, hey, I'm your friend because I'm not gonna tax you. But if you're poor and oftentimes, brown or black or a minority, guess what? The state is gonna come, shake you down one way or another for that traffic fine or that, that petty, marijuana possession fine or whatever. And sometimes, and then of course you get into the whole prison industrial complex, and the profit motive in the private prison industry. It is systemic. Anyone who, hopefully I'm not, stepping in hot water here, but I don't see how anyone can deny that this is a systemic issue, right? It's a thing that is so complex and so hard to unravel. And the first thing you have to do is you have to admit what the factors are, and it's hard to even get there.
I know.
And yeah. Anyway.
It's several hundred years of history and of wide, this multicultural society coming together and all these, and there, everyone has a different perspective. There's a different, all of these incidents are so complicated, and we try to boil them down, and the same thing with the solutions. They're going to be complex. I'm with you. I don't know what happens next. What was Mattis's final thoughts?
Yeah, sorry, I never finished really answering your. I don't think. Yeah, I wanted to close that down or close that up because I think I went on a tangent again. But to give the full background, I reached out to Mattis for the essay years ago and just kind of started a correspondence with him. Just occasionally, would. To be perfectly honest, like I think for that essay, he kind of, I requested an interview and he kind of turned me down. He was like, he turned me down in the best way possible though. I sent him an email and like within 5 minutes, the guy called me back. And I mean, just imagine, man, I was like, I'm sitting there and I'm like, hello, I was like, hey, it's Jim Mattis. It's like what? I worked in Hollywood for like 3 years. I've met like so many like A-list actors, man. I never, ever, ever got starstruck. Like couldn't, like even people I was fans of, I was like, I never was like, oh my God, I'm your biggest fan. But like Jim Mattis called me. I was like, oh my God, but he was like, hey, Ethan, I think this is a cool essay you're writing, but, I'd rather not, comment on it. But And part of the reason is because I already mentioned it. He's like, as you mentioned, I've already been quoted on this topic, frequently, and there's a lot of stuff that you can pull out there. But that was the beginning of I had actually met him once before that while I was in active duty, just very briefly at a conference where he spoke. But that was kind of the beginning of our I guess, minimal relationship. And then there was a couple other times that I think I sent him that essay after I wrote it. And, he gave me some great feedback and praise, which I very much valued. And it was just from there, it was just like, I guess we're friends now, it's what, to the extent that much interaction you can be, but the long and short of it is if I email him, with whatever request, he may turn down an interview request, but he will always respond. It took him, I had emailed him after he put out a statement, after the Lafayette Park incident. I think I emailed him, with a request for something. And, it took him like a week to get back. And he was very apologetic. And he said, "Hey, I'm really sorry it's taking this long to get back to you, but I literally have been going through thousands of emails since I put out that statement." And so that kind of like opened a dialogue a little bit. And so we traded a few emails, and, you know, one of the things he wrote in there was the quote that I kind of ended the piece with, that I thought was, you know, pretty much spot on. Like I was 100%, you know, kind of in the same mindset. And if I had it in front of me, I would, you know, read it. But, you know, it was basically like, you know, this, my hope is that we come out on the other end of this better, you know, by rising to the occasion, you know. And one of my favorite lines from that quote, or what he wrote was, do you by chance
have it? I don't have it right here with me. I have to pull it up here. One sec here.
Here, I'm pulling it up and with my slow internet. And but I will read it because I think it is absolutely something you know, people need to hear.
Let me see.
Here. Okay, so he said, at the end of the quote, he says, "Hang in there, stay decent, even when others are not, and hold the line strongly until our nation recovers its respect and friendship for all our fellow citizens." The "stay decent, even when others are not," like, really was profound to me, because that's how I kind of try to live my life, you know, that's like my personal values, and this, just the kind of, with everything going on and all the extremism, you know, context of everything, you know, that was very important. Stay decent, even when others are not. Like, that's my advice to everyone, you know, stay decent. So did I finally answer your question?
I think that is perfect. And I think it's something we can all do. So regardless of your political ideology or where you sit on the ideological spectrum, no matter how much you disagree with somebody, even if they're not being decent to you, be decent, try to be a decent person. I mean, that seems like good advice. And
yeah, I mean, I'll say that, you know, if you're you know, attacking me with your fists or what, you know, I mean, like I certainly say there's a line there, you know. But yeah, absolutely.
But even then, I'm sorry, but even then, you can still be decent. So like like when I was a police officer, some police officers I knew, and I tried to myself, I didn't always succeed in it, but to become involved in a physical confrontation or even in a fight with somebody, as soon as you gain a dominant position, render aid, treat them with respect,
right.
You know, treat them like a human being, explain what's been happening. Talk to the people that were involved, you know, like, treating people with respect and dignity, and even when someone's trying to hurt you, I think that's great advice for police officers.
And that's a really difficult thing to do, right? In that kind of heated context, you know, I mentioned that because I think it's important, you know, like the media narrative of this of you know, excessive use of force by police and police brutality, you know, it tends to be very, very simple, and you know. And there's often not, like, you don't get to talk about, or you know, people don't like to recognize that, like, if you were in that situation, you wouldn't be thinking, you know, the most clear-headed individual either. You know, you would be affected greatly by your emotions in that context. And that's something that, and that's what we talk about when we talk about that, like, high standard, right? Is like, you know, military commanders will say, you know, like, my Marines have to, their behavior has to be, you know, above reproach, right? I mean, that's the challenge for cops all the time, is like, you're confronting a lot of really, oftentimes a lot of really nasty people, you know, and you know, to be able to, like, flip that switch and be like, okay, now I have to go back into decent mode. It's
really tough.
It's not an easy thing. And it's difficult, man.
Well, I think that part of the solution also is to frame that being decent as the like the an example of being like frame it as being heroic, like as frame it as be like to celebrate that, to turn it into like a characteristic of, especially amongst men in law enforcement, a form of an expression of masculinity, like the future, like how we want men to behave. I'm sorry to make it gender, but what I'm trying to say is that we should place value on that and celebrate that ability to restrain yourself and switch back into that mode.
Absolutely. This is like, we're like trying to wrap up, but you keep bringing good points. That's something that I think about a lot is, you know, like Western civilization has, like, the Western canon from like the Bible forward is full of like, of these wonderful examples, literary examples, you know, and archetypes of virtue, right? And the Western ideal of virtue is not the tyrant cutthroat warrior, right? It's the incredible warrior who is also capable of containing that, mm-hmm. right? And you know, that's the ideal. It's men, you know, men who are capable of violence, but have a handle on it, right? And have a balance. And that's our ideal of virtue, is that you have this strength and this power, but you have this humility, right, that keeps it in check. And you know, this recognition of like both the micro and the macro and the short term and the long term, you know, and that's the challenge, right? And that's what makes, you know, like a great leader is people who can like kind of, I think, see all of those factors and understand how to balance them. And it's tough, man. It's tough to instill those, you know, those values and standards and discipline. And you know, but I will say that leadership is everything, you know.
I agree.
I absolutely believe that, you know, if you've got a toxic leader, you know, as your chief of police or sheriff or, you know, whatever, any, name a context, right? And that leader doesn't believe, you know, say you've got a, you know, a racist, you know, chief of police or a racist sheriff, you know, like, you know, that's going to trickle down. It's going to affect the whole institution. So leadership is everything. You know, one of the stories I wrote a few weeks back I published a Q&A with Sheriff Swanson out in, he's the sheriff out in Genesee County, Michigan. They serve Flint, Michigan. And he's the guy who, he went viral because he walked with protesters, you know, Black Lives Matter protesters. He like went out, he said, "Hey, look, I took my helmet off and put my baton down. I'm here to listen, you know," and he's like, "What do you guys need?" And they were like, walk with us. And then he marched with them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then he forged a relationship with them. And that guy, you know, I encourage anybody to, you know, maybe you can like share a link.
I'll put a link in the description. Yeah.
Yeah, I would encourage anyone to like just read that Q&A. I mean, he struck me as a really great leader with the right ideas, you know, because he understands, you know, that he's a public servant first and foremost, and that, you know, you have to communicate with the community members you serve, and you have to be humble and empathetic and all that jazz. And he touched on a lot of different, you know, issues that we're all talking about and are salient. That I think he has a lot of really good thoughts and ideas. My thing is, you know, I've never been a cop. I'm certainly not a subject matter expert. When I need to communicate or write a story about you know, police or criminal justice, you know, I go to subject matter experts. I go to cops. I go to, you know, to law enforcement leaders and talk to those guys. And, you know, I think that, like he said, one of the things he said in there is, I believe that right now is the time that like the best leaders are going to rise, in law enforcement. And we are going to see, better days ahead for that reason. I hope he's right. I hope he's right. But long and short of it is like, you can't. I personally, you should never get to that point where you're so disconnected with the community that you serve that the only way you can police them is, maybe I should skip that. Well, the long story short is that it's very unfortunate that there are communities out there where there's such a huge disconnect between the community and the police. And there's no easy answer there, for how you fix that. I know that. But I think that you have to do everything in your power to build those bridges with the, with community leaders and the people you serve, and be committed to truly serving them. And I, like I said, I don't have all the answers. I don't know exactly how that looks and how that comes about, but I do know that, it's hard work and you have to commit to it.
Yeah. It's a long road ahead. And I hope that, your police officer friend is your, Michigan, you said, is right, and that brighter days are ahead. I want to thank you for your time, and can I get a commitment to come back on in maybe a few months and talk about what's happened since?
Dude, absolutely. You don't have to ask me twice to talk too much, okay. Man. It's kind of my thing. No, so
that's why I love doing this. Yeah. I get to talk to interesting people, and so it's great. I'm going to put a link in the description below to the article that you wrote, to the interview, the Q&A you mentioned, and also if you could just send me any other links you want put in the description, and I'll put those in so people can find you, and I'll put a link to your website as well, and to Coffee or Die, so they can follow all of your content, as well as your social media contact information. So you can be followed. Any final thoughts before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I want to do the shameless plug thing here and say, if you have an interest in the military veterans, first responders, coffee history, culture in general, American culture in general, and that's the big umbrella that I love, and entertainment relating to these topics. Please check out Coffee or Die. Our online magazine has been around for a couple years now. Our founders have done a great job building it, and we're growing and expanding and trying to do really great things with the journalism that we chase and produce, and the essays and content that we put out there. So keep an eye on us. Hopefully we're going to be putting out lots of great content that you guys will want to come back for more. So coffeeordie.com.